It's not the home that I need, but I'll stay. 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 But I'll stay.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and our arts coordinator Genevieve Hinch. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Era McCauley, covering the Francophone Working Group's midterm report to Kingston City Council.
The Francophone Working Group, Le Groupe de Travail Francophone, represented by Vice Chair Lauriane Monpetit, the Executive Director of Association Canadienne Française de l'Ontario, Conseil Régional de Mille-Îles, ACFOMI, and Melanie DeWeiss, Chair of ACFOMI's Board of Directors, appeared before Council to speak to the group's midterm report.
Je suis Lauriane Monpetit, directrice de l'ACFOMI et vice-présidente du Groupe de Travail Francophone de la ville de Kingston.
Et je suis Mélanie DeWise, membre du groupe francophone et présidente de l'ACFOMI Lille.
We are a vibrant, visible and deeply rooted community in the Kingston identity.
Established in 2024, the Francophone Working Group represents the interests of Francophone community in Kingston, including promoting existing French language programming, increasing access to city services in French, and examining city initiatives, events, and policies through a Francophone lens. The group emerged following a 2023 council directive to city staff to investigate opportunities to improve engagement with Francophone community, including the feasibility of creating a committee.
So it's been nearly 2 years since we requested the creation of a dedicated Francophone working group. Today, we stand before you with the midterm report of this working group. So the creation of the working group in December 2024 was a major step forward. Over the past several months, we have built a strong bridge between the community and the municipal departments.
The working group is mandated to help the city better meet the needs of Francophone residents by advocating for French language municipal services and to promote the local community's bilingual and inclusive character, informing municipal diversity, equity, and inclusion measures. In its midterm report, the working group highlighted several achievements since their term began, including access to city forms in French, funding support for Francophone daycare providers, and collaborating with members of the city's cultural sector, resulting in activities such as a bilingual youth open mic and an augmented reality workshop.
Here are a few achievements of this group. First, Francophones can now submit nominations for city committees directly in French, allowing for improved civic participation. Second, we have made a major stride in childcare and education. Kingston's Francophone daycares now have access to municipality-funded training in French, establishing equity with English language daycares. Furthermore, administrative communications and reports between these childcare centers and the city can now be processed in French. Third, our cultural presence is stronger. We have collaborated successfully with the city cultural sector, including music, film, and media offices, to deliver bilingual youth events and workshops. Finally, after being stalled for 4 years, we have successfully revived the initiative to fly the Franco-Ontarian flag at City Hall. These are just symbolic wins that are functional improvements to the daily lives of Kingston citizens.
but our work is far from being over.
The delegation also presented action items to Council centered around safety and emergencies and IIDEA inclusion, including recognition of Franco-Ontarian Day. They spoke to past assimilation practices and a desire to celebrate Francophone culture in the community.
The first priority is safety. So we would like to ensure that all municipal emergency messaging is automatically issued also in French. In a crisis, timely information in one's primary language can save lives. Secondly, we would like for the Francophone community to be identified as a priority group within the city's indigenization, inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility, so the IIDEA initiatives. So this would allow the staff to, from that department to support initiatives for Francophones, such as Franco-Ontarian Day. This would place the Francophones in the same manner or having the same support as this city supports Emancipation Day, National Truth and Reconciliation Day, amongst others.
Franco-Ontarian Day, celebrated annually on September 25th, honors the over 400-year history, culture, and contributions of Franco-Ontarians. September 25th is the anniversary of the raising of the first Franco-Ontarian flag in 1975 at the University of Sudbury. Councillor Shinani asked the delegates why the city should support Franco-Ontarian Day.
So you mentioned Franco-Ontarian Day. So can you explain why the city should support Franco-Ontarian Day?
Yes, thank you for the question. So Francophones are the largest minority language group in Kingston. So that means that, you know, supporting this Franco-Ontarian Day would also mean supporting a sizable portion of local residents. It celebrates the presence of Francophones in the region and in Ontario, so 400 years of Francophone presence, but also the ongoing fight against cultural assimilation that came from different rules and regulations like Règlement 17, which didn't allow Francophones to learn in French for a long period of time. It also fulfills the city's diversity goals. There are more and more Francophones in the city, especially newcomers that are coming in. So it would allow to boost the community's visibility and showcase that the city of Kingston is inclusive of all.
According to the 2021 City of Kingston census, over 5,000 people in Kingston identified French as their first official language of choice, making it the second most used language in the city. The group noted that Francophone communities in Kingston have been asking for the Franco-Ontarian flag to be flown at City Hall for more than 4 years.
After the approval of Council in 2022 of the Franco-Ontarian flag being displayed, the process has stalled. The Francophone community was not consulted or made aware of the progress or lack of progress until the working group met in late 2025.
The report tabled other suggestions, including a request to offer a French version of the city calendar and events online, compile a list of all city services that are available in French, and support and prioritize funding for projects and initiatives that meet Francophone community needs.
The progress we have made proves that when the city of Kingston and the Francophone community collaborate, we create a more inclusive city for everyone.
Councillor Chinani followed up on this, asking about the current level of accessibility in the city's websites for French language users.
Do you find that you're able to find which, like some outlined French services on the website, or is that still a challenge?
So although some services are mandated by the provincial government to be available in French, and those pages are bilingual, there's no way to navigate to see what services are available in French in Kingston. And so it would be ideal to have one place where you can see all the services that are available by the city, but also in the city.
We are focused on transparency and accessibility. We would like to see a comprehensive list of all city services currently available in French, so residents, especially new residents, can easily access the information needed.
A final report from the Francophone Working Group will be expected in 2028.
Thank you, Era. Now over to Dinah Jansen with a story by Michelle Dory Forestell, LJI reporter for The Kingstonist, about Greater Napanee Council's decision to review water privatization in light of a deputation from members of the St. Mary Magdalene Anglican Church.
Thank you, Jesse. Members of the St. Mary Magdalene Anglican Church appeared before Greater Napanee Council Tuesday night, urging the municipality to keep its water and wastewater infrastructure firmly in public hands while raising concerns about recent provincial legislation they fear could reduce municipal control over local water systems. On Tuesday, May 26th, a deputation delivered by parishioners Valerie Smith and Chuck Hill during a regular meeting of council was tied to the Anglican Diocese of Ontario's recent adoption of the International Blue Communities Framework, a movement centered on treating water as a public good rather than a commodity. The Blue Communities Project was launched in 2009 by advocacy organizations including the Council of Canadians, the Blue Planet Project, and the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Participating municipalities and institutions commit to recognizing water and sanitation as human rights, reducing reliance on bottled water, and promoting publicly owned and operated water and wastewater services. The concerns raised at council also align with a broader Blue Community campaign that has recently taken hold locally. Earlier this year, the Diocese of Ontario formally became a certified Blue Community, a designation tied to commitments supporting public ownership of water and wastewater systems. Campaign organizers have said some local parishes, including St. Mary Magdalene in Napanee, planned to approach municipal officials seeking assurances that water infrastructure would remain publicly controlled amid the town's proposed $75 million expansion. According to material published by the diocese, the movement explicitly opposes privatization and public-private partnership models, commonly referred to as P3S. Smith told council the diocese now encourages each parish to advocate locally for publicly controlled water infrastructure. She argued that public ownership ensures water will be shared by everyone, not made into a commodity to be sold to for-profit corporations or public-private partnerships. However, Smith also went beyond the prepared deputation to raise concerns about recent Ontario legislation affecting municipal water systems. She argued the legislation could eventually reduce municipal control over local water systems. The concerns raised during the deputation appear to be tied to Ontario's recently enacted Water and Wastewater Public Corporations Act, introduced through Bill 60 and later amended through Schedule 9 of Bill 98. Bill 60, formerly known as the Fighting Delays, Building Faster Act 2025, created a framework that allows the province to designate municipally focused water and wastewater public corporations to provide water and wastewater services on behalf of lower-tier municipalities. Critics of the framework, including groups connected to the Blue Community movement, have raised concerns that the model could reduce municipal control over local water systems or eventually create pathways to privatization. Amendments later introduced through the omnibus Bill 98 Schedule 9 Water and Wastewater Public Corporations Act 2025 added provisions restricting corporate ownership to municipalities or public sector entities, measures the province said would help ensure the corporations remain publicly controlled. However, some advocacy groups continue to argue that the legislation still grants the province broad authority over municipal water governance structures. The parishioners also referenced Greater Napanee's new water pollution control plant, expressing relief that the project appears set to remain publicly owned despite contributions from the federal and provincial governments and municipal reserve funding. While no members of council directly endorsed the parishioners' interpretation of the legislation, they agreed that the issue needed further review. Mayor Terry Richardson said the concerns should be reviewed and reported back to council at a future meeting. Council ultimately voted to receive the deputation and direct staff to prepare a report responding to the issues raised. The deputation stopped short of asking council to adopt the Blue Community designation directly. Instead, parishioners focused primarily on seeking assurances that Greater Napanee's water infrastructure will remain publicly controlled amid broader debates around infrastructure financing, privatization, and municipal autonomy.
Thank you, Dinah, and thank you to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Ted Evans, LJI reporter for CJAI Amherst Island Radio, about Loyalist Township's decision to waive the emergency services fee for the Odessa Fair in July.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township Council has agreed to a request made by the Odessa Agricultural Society to waive fees for emergency services at the Tractor Pull and Demolition Derby during the Odessa Fair, taking place July 24th to 26th. Secretary and volunteer with the society, Stephanie Gimo, spoke about the fair and the increase in costs.
The Odessa Fair has been a staple of Odessa for 191 years and has traditionally relied on emergency fire services at no cost to us for fair events. This bylaw is a drastic increase to our budget that we had not foreseen. As a nonprofit volunteer-run organization, we do not have the reserve funds to cover the substantial cost increase to operate these community favorite events at the annual fair.
Gimo noted the breakdown of costs for emergency services.
Deputy Chief Grenham stated that the Agricultural Society would be required to pay for the fire emergency services for the Tractor Pull and Demolition Derby at the annual Odessa Fair taking place July 24th to 26th. Based on the hours the fire department was required for these events in 2025, the cost would be $8,472.20 for the Tractor Pull and $3,230.52 for the Demolition Derby, totaling $11,703.20. These fees include the MTO's apparatus hourly rate and the hourly wage of each firefighter for these events.
Alongside partnering with the township for events like Trunk or Treat, Gimo spoke about how proceeds from the fair are used and how important the agricultural grounds are for the community.
The proceeds from the fair enable the Agricultural Society to continue to maintain the agricultural grounds and its buildings. The grounds offer a park-like setting for the community to enjoy, and the large palace building is a space for the community to come together. The Lions Club prepares the holiday baskets in this space, and free events for families such as See and Learn are held on the fairgrounds.
With the original staff recommendation being to receive the delegation request from the society, Councillor Jake Ennis also added the motion to waive the fees.
I would move that council receive the delegation request from the Odessa Agricultural Society and to approve the request for waiver of emergency services fees.
So moved. Do I have a seconder? Councillor Bubert.
Ennis noted possible funding options for the future.
I think it's a long-standing event, community event that's worth supporting. And I think perhaps if we support it this year, the organization could look to the community grant fund in the future as a possibility. But I think it's a long-standing event that we should continue to support.
Councillor Mike Buderick spoke about the importance of supporting events like the fair in the community.
I believe, too, that we should support anything that gets people in our community out, and such a long-standing tradition of the Odessa Fair and even the Tractor Pull is fantastic. Great crowds, and it's great to see people in our community come out and support things.
Council also asked for a staff report to help guide decisions for future events. Councillor Paul Proderick noted why they want the report.
There's no doubt that over the years, this has been a very valuable, 191 years. I think that's while my grandparents were at that fair when they lived in Railton. And as we sort of move ahead, we want to quantify things just so we get an overall picture. And a staff report looking at that for next year, maybe there's back and forth questions that can be answered, such as, do you really need six firefighters or whatever? I mean, things like that that can come out of a report.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
And thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Coming up next, we have Genevieve Hinch reading a story by Keith Dempsey, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about Gananoque Town Council's controversial vote to defer a decision on publicly recording and releasing council meetings until the next council term.
Thank you, Dinah. Mayor John Beddoes says transparency and public accountability are at risk in Gananoque following a pair of recent council motions involving public access to meetings and the municipality's integrity commissioner complaint process. The comments come after council voted to defer a decision on publicly recording and releasing council meetings until the next term of council. The motion was introduced by Con David Osmond. Council also unanimously supported a separate motion for Osmond directing staff to review the municipality's integrity commissioner complaint process, including the possibility of introducing fees ranging by $500 to $1,000 for complaints involving council conduct. Beddoes criticized both developments, arguing they could weaken accountability at Town Hall. The debate comes among ongoing tensions surrounding the municipality's integrity commissioner process. Osmond has been the subject of three integrity commissioner complaints, all of which were ultimately dismissed or closed without findings or wrongdoing. Osmond said the complaints process has been personally difficult and financially costly for taxpayers. In October of 2025, Osmond was cleared following a complaint connected to comments involving the mayor's strong budget powers and remarks related to Quebec license plates. Osmond said the matter cost taxpayers approximately $2,260. A second complaint filed in November 2025 was dismissed without investigation after the integrity commissioner determined the allegations lacked merit. According to Osmond, he said the initial review cost approximately $800, while an appeal filed by the complainant required an additional response, costing roughly $200. A third complaint, Osmond said, stemmed from an exchange involving cats and his use of the word screed in a written response to a resident. Osmond said his request that the related matters be made public, but he was advised that doing so could reveal the identity of the complainant. He described the overall experience as stressful and damaging to the municipality's reputation. Osmond maintains that there should be some costs associated with filing complaints and said his motions only request a staff report outlining possible options and recommendations. One option could involve retaining filing fees if complaints are dismissed, with funds potentially offsetting legal costs. Beddoes, meanwhile, said he supported having staff prepare a report, but made it clear he would oppose any final proposal that creates financial barriers to complaints being filed. The dispute also intersects with a broader disagreement surrounding the role of the town's integrity commissioner, Tony Fleming, who also serves as legal counsel for the municipality. Beddoes long argued the dual role represents a conflict of interest. The issues surrounding council transparency, governance, and accountability are expected to remain key topics in Gananoque as the municipality moves closer to the 2026 municipal election campaign.
And thank you to Genevieve Hinch and Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to CFRC's Jesse Bell with the Kingston Sports Report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays.
Thank you, Dinah. Saturday, May 30th marked another landmark day for the Queens men's football team, as five program draft picks dressed for a CFL clash between the Edmonton Elks and the Calgary Stampeders. Saturday's contest closed out the CFL's three-week preseason. It served as a final opportunity for coaches to evaluate young players and determine their position on the rosters for the 2026 regular season. Calgary and Edmonton have drafted six of the last seven Queens draft picks since 2024. The Stampeders selected number 39 Ashton Miller-Melançon in the eighth round of the 2025 draft, and defensive lineman number 79 Stephen Capea in the seventh round of this year's draft. Edmonton has become something of a Queens West as of late, as they have built a strong recruiting pipeline to Ontario's oldest football program. The Elks drafted linebacker Olivier Mouembi in the third round of the 2024 draft, defensive tackle Darian Newell in the second round, and Silas Hubert in the fourth round of the 2025 draft, and most recently, linebacker Justin Pace in the fourth round of the 2026 draft. Worth noting that Newell did not dress for Saturday's contest, but his five tricolor teammates did. Ashton Miller-Melançon would tally a special teams tackle on punt coverage for Calgary. Silas Hubert would pick up a tackle for Edmonton, but it was Justin Pace who made the biggest waves during the preseason, with multiple pass breakups in the Week 2 contest and a sack on Saturday against Calgary. Pace and Capea
are eligible to return for the 2026 U Sports season, but there is a distinct possibility that Pace will be on the Edmonton regular season roster thanks to his outstanding preseason performances. Calgary would ultimately prevail 21-18 over Edmonton. The CFL regular season starts on Thursday, June 4th, with a 7:30 p.m. game between the Montreal Alouettes and the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
And thank you to Jesse Bell for that update. And also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, June 3rd, daytime high of 23 degrees here in the city of Kingston with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 11 overnight. We're going to get a slight uptick in temperatures for Thursday, June 4th. 26 is your high with a mix of sun and cloud, but we do have a 30% chance of precipitation overnight, dropping things down to 13 degrees. Friday, June 5th, another 26-degree day forecasted here for the city of Kingston, but a 40% chance of rain throughout the day, dropping down to 15 overnight. Saturday, June 6th, our third straight 26-degree day in a row, once again forecast with a mix of sun and cloud. Things will cool off slightly for Sunday, June 7th, daytime high of 23 with a 40% chance of precipitation. But we're going to have a beautiful start to next week as Monday, June 8th, we have a daytime high of 25 with lots of bright sunshine. Should be a beautiful week here in the city of Kingston.
Let's send it back over to Genevieve Hinch for CFRC's concert and events calendar for the week.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar. Whether you're looking for live music, local markets, trivia nights, theater, workshops, or just something fun to do around the city, there's plenty happening in Kingston this week. Let's get into it. On Wednesday, Thrives 365 is hosting Bird Life on Campus, a walk to notice nature at Miller Hall from 11 a.m. to noon. Later on, both Something in the Water Brewing Company and the Royal Canadian Legion are hosting board game nights starting at 5 and 6 p.m. Daft Brewing and La Vida Bistro also have trivia and euchre running throughout the evening. If you're looking for live music, Bobby Cameron performs at the Bank Gastro Bar while Glenn Jones, Liam Grant, and Jack Pine take over Something Else Records from 4 to 6 p.m. The Grad Club also hosts an open stage drag show beginning at 8 p.m. Thursday keeps things busy with the Kingston Public Market running all day in Springer Market Square from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Tet Center is hosting both a needle felted landscape workshop and make a robot butterfly workshop in the evening. If comedy is more your thing, Daft Brewing has a stand-up comedy night from 8 to 11 p.m. Live music includes Clear Breeze at Hotel Wolf Island, Lotus White performing at Monte's as part of the sit-down series, and Sam Coons alongside Lankis Pell at the RCHA Club. Theater lovers can also check out Very Heaven at Domino Theater starting at 7:30. Friday is packed with concerts and nightlife around the city. The Tet Center hosts their quick and cute scrapbook and card classes from 6 to 8:45 p.m., while Dream, the greatest show, takes over the Kingston Grand Theater at 7 p.m. Live music includes Gershwin, Porter & Me, featuring Angela, Verbrugge, and Ray Gallen at Hotel Wolf Island, Lucas Oak at the Loaf and Ale Pub, and Celtic Kitchen Party at the Turnanog later in the evening. Trivia returns to Wild Wing Kingston while karaoke takes over both the Buckle and Daft Brewing starting at 9 p.m. Heading into Saturday, Earthfest takes over Confederation Park from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., while the Kingston Public Market returns to Springer Market Square, and the Tet Center is also hosting Be the Ark, singing the collective action from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Live music highlights Big Mo and the Blues Mission at the RCHA Club, Cut Flowers at Hotel Wolf Island, and the Brian Adams Tribute Experience at Overtime Sports Bar. If you're looking for something interactive, live line dancing returns to the Buckle from 7 to 8 p.m. While the Tech Gallery hosts Collage Club, crafting to create community from 2 to 5 p.m. Live music includes Eric Urin and Megan Ballone returning to the Cove Inn, while the Cantabile Choirs of Kingston and the Kingston Symphony Orchestra perform Sunrise Mass at the Isabel Bader Center. Karaoke also returns to the Merchant Tap House at 9 p.m. That's your weekly events and concerts calendar for June 1st through the 7th. For more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdoctoral fellows are working on. Today, I would like to introduce you to Kanna Ogawa, who recently completed her master's in the Department of Translational Medicine under the supervision of Drs. Teresa and Jamie Persner. Welcome to Grad Chat, Kanna.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much for coming in today, especially after you've just defended and been so busy. But if we take it back a little bit, what made you interested in undertaking graduate research in translational medicine at Queen's in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reason why I was really interested in the translational medicine program, so it's called TMED for short, but it's a research-based graduate program where all the students engage in really cool different types of research spanning different fields. Mm. And all of us have kind of like a center point, which is that the research that we engage in has a translational significance. So whatever we do, we hope to make a good impact into the clinical setting to help patients and their future in terms of either understanding how diseases work or quality improvement in the hospital setting, all things like that. So I thought this is something really important, and this is something that I wanted to be part of.
Mm, that sounds very practical and important. So, I mean, basic research is important too, but this type of applied research, I'm sure it's fun to see how you can have an impact immediately in a clinical setting. And is that unique to Queen's? Are there other programs like that across Canada?
I think this is a really unique program. I'm not really sure how many, but there's only a few in Canada, which is a translational medicine specific graduate program. And so it's super cool. Not only did we get to engage in our research, we also had interesting opportunities like observerships, where we got to observe physicians and really understand the impact of our research. And we were also able to attend something called medical ground rounds and observe discussions that happen and what kind of cool research goes on in the Queen's community.
Oh, very nice. So that's very exciting. And I'm sure it sounds like very motivating, right, to get to go around the hospital and see directly how research, even if it's not yours immediately, but seeing how other research and new practices are directly influencing patient care at KGH and in the wider community as well. And your research, your master's thesis was titled The Generation of Alternative Transcripts as a Means of Regulating Phosphorylation in Sonic Hedgehog Medulloblastoma. Now, that sounds very complex to me. Can you give a little bit of an overview of your project for maybe someone like myself who doesn't have a background in life sciences or medicine?
Yeah, certainly. So, yeah, it is quite a complex process, many different parts. And so overall, I think as the name suggests, I'm looking at a mechanism that's new, and to see if this is something that actually happens in our body. Is phosphorylation regulated at the level of the transcript? So I want to take a step back and kind walk through what this whole process is and what my research entails. But basically, phosphorylation is a really important process in our body that's important in development and cancer progression.
Okay.
And so this this process is controlled by molecules called kinases, where kinases goes into a protein and then adds a phosphate group. And that is a process of phosphorylation.
Okay. Does that happen often? Is that like a unique process or is that common? Like what does that look like?
Yeah, it's actually a really common process. I believe two-thirds of over 20,000 proteins in our human body are phosphorylated. So you can see how significant that is.
Okay, so lots of it's happening all over the place constantly in the human body.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I just want to add, a problem with kinases is that they're known as blunt instruments in that they are reversible and they're able to phosphorylate or target many different proteins and attach these phosphate groups onto them. So then a fundamental question in biology arises, which is that how do you selectively regulate this promiscuous kinase process of phosphorylation? How do you regulate phosphorylation at the protein level? And then how do you specifically make sure that you're targeting one particular phosphorylation event without overall affecting the others?
Okay, so in cancer development and progression, if you're trying to treat one area, kinases seem to, you might impact way too many of them at once and have other detrimental effects instead of just impacting the one that's related to the cancer development or growth. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So with this overall effect, we think then, what if the regulation of phosphorylation doesn't actually happen at the protein level? Or maybe it obviously it does, but what if we actually take it a step back and look at regulation of phosphorylation at the transcript level? So
Can you tell me what the transcript level is? Because I'm not too certain about that.
Yeah, so in terms of, I guess, explaining where, you know, transcripts and proteins lie in our body, there's a process called central dogma, where essentially in our body we go from DNA, which is our genes, our blueprint of information, to RNA, which is the transcript level, which is kind of specific instructions, and then the protein, which is what is essentially made from the specific instructions of the RNA. So you know, we think of everything at the protein level, but then why don't we take a step back and look at the RNA level? And mRNA in particular, messenger RNA. And then so that is the mechanism that I'm exploring, if phosphorylation is regulated in the transcript level. And I looked at two specific processes, which are alternative splicing and alternative transcription start sites, which allow you to generate a wide variety of different transcripts that produce different proteins.
Okay.
So kind of like, think of it as an analogy like I like to do is, let's say there's like a protein, and it's essentially the same protein, but there's different flavors of the protein.
Oh, okay. So it's like the mRNA is kind of like giving you a general recipe, and then how that's interpreted in the body results in different proteins. So if you had like a flavor of a base level of cake, and then you had different flavors of cake based on what the mRNA told you to add flavor-wise, is that an okay interpretation?
That's a great analogy. So essentially, alternative transcription start site and alternative splicing, what they essentially do, this is getting really nitty-gritty, but we have something called exons in our body, and that's the part that essentially gets translated into a protein. But these mechanisms, they can either attach or exclude exons in different arrangements, thereby creating this protein diversity. So these are the different combination, aka recipes, I guess, that could translate into a wide range of proteins.
Okay, so you're investigating two mechanisms, alternative transcription sites and alternative splicing, as ways to intervene and change the outcomes of those proteins, correct?
Exactly. Okay. So now you got it. So basically, think of a protein including a phosphorylation site. If it includes it, then it's going to get phosphorylated, and we're going to have this effect on, you know, development in cancer. But then what if the recipe or the instructions doesn't contain the phosphorylation site to begin with? Then when it gets made into a protein, it's not going to contain that site of phosphorylation. And maybe this can be a method that is employed by development and cancer to ultimately regulate phosphorylation.
Okay. So where did you test this? Because I remember in your title, there was a thing called sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma. So where does that come into your research project?
Yeah, so sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma is the model we use to study this mechanism. And it's a great model to study because if this mechanism were to happen anywhere, it will be in cancer, which evolves so quickly. And sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma, I'll tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah, that would be great. I've never heard of it. I've heard of sonic hedgehog, but never sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma.
Yeah, so medulloblastoma is the most common childhood brain tumor of the cerebellum. And the sonic hedgehog subtype accounts for 30% of all medulloblastoma cases.
Oh, wow. So this is a very common type of pediatric brain cancer then. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so the sonic hedgehog subtype, its name is really funny. It's because it's reliant on a process called sonic hedgehog signaling pathway.
Okay.
And this is a process or signaling pathway that's really important in our body. We all go through it when our brain forms through cerebellar development. But then when it gets dysregulated, this pathway can go crazy. And essentially when that happens, through things like mutations, a medulloblastoma ultimately develops.
Okay. And is there a reason for the name in particular?
Yeah, so sonic hedgehog signaling, I think it's based on, I'm not really sure exactly the study that was behind it, but from my understanding, a group of researchers found that a mutation in flies caused the fly to have a very spiked appearance in their back, kind of like the character Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay, so it's based on that early study and those results. So now, I mean, it's a great way to remember the terminology. So you're looking at signaling in hedgehog medulloblastoma, and then you're looking to see if you can regulate this phosphorylation through going back and before the protein phase in the mRNA stage, in the transcription stage. And what did you find when you were testing alternative transcription site and alternative splicing methods? What did you find when you were doing this?
Yeah, so I compared the cancer model, which is a medulloblastoma model, to granule neuron precursors, which is the normal kind of tissue model.
Oh.
So essentially, in terms of our normal development, granule neuron precursors, they undergo sonic hedgehog signaling, and then this allows these cells to divide and then ultimately turn into something called granule neurons, which are the most abundant cells in our brain.
Okay.
But then if we have, you know, things like mutations happen, it can result in disruptions in the signaling pathway, where we undergo rapid proliferation, so rapid division, and uncontrolled growth, ultimately turning into a medulloblastoma tumor. So you can see that these granule neuron precursors and medulloblastoma cells, they act as great comparisons to study my process and figure out exactly what is happening in development and then what is happening in tumor progression. So what I did was I had different data sets that were previously generated from my lab.
Okay.
And this includes data sets like phosphoproteomics, which essentially looks at changes in phosphorylation that is happening between the development model versus the tumor model. And then I also had an RNA sequencing data set, which looks at the RNA changes, so transcript level changes that are happening between the development and cancer. And then I combined these two data sets, and then I figured out essentially from development to cancer, what is exactly happening, what changes are happening in terms of phosphorylation, and what changes are happening in terms of the transcript, which identifies that these candidates that we're looking for is undergoing either alternative splicing or alternative transcription start sites to ultimately find potential candidates that undergo these mechanisms that we can identify and investigate further.
Okay, so you were looking for ways to find things, that candidates that could do the regulation piece. And did you find any of those, or do you have to keep doing more research after your master's?
Well, yeah, in terms of more research, that is definitely...
Okay, fair enough. Research never ends. Sorry.
Research never ends. But yeah, we found 12 really interesting candidates out of a lot of different phosphorylation events. And in particular, I experimentally validated two candidates. They're called RNF220 and CEP9, in which they had high changes in phosphorylation, as well as changes in the transcript level in medulloblastoma compared to the granule neuron precursors.
Okay, so again, for someone who does not have a background in life science, can you tell me what RNF220 and CEP9 are?
Yeah, so RNF220 is a protein, and previous literature shows that it's involved in medulloblastoma progression, and it's also involved in the sonic hedgehog signaling pathway.
Mm.
And it's called a ubiquitin ligase, and
okay.
Essentially it's involved in a process of attaching to proteins and then helping it degrade for kind of like maintenance purposes.
Mm, so it helps the protein degrade so that it into smaller pieces to be used throughout cells or wherever it's needed in the body, or not quite?
I guess not quite in terms of using it for other purposes. It's more so kind of like a regulation. So let's say we don't want this protein to be expressed, then we can degrade it so that it's no longer there.
Okay, I was wrong. You were very polite, but that was a way to to explain it. And what is CEP9?
Yeah, CEP9 is also really relevant in terms of cancer. There's a lot of research done on breast cancer and CEP9. And it's known to be a oncogene in that it actually progresses a tumor.
Mm. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, CEP9, it's involved with the cytoskeleton of our cells, so kind of like the overall structure of the cell. And it's also involved in actin and microfilaments within the cell. So very, very structural, kind of like the structural aspect of our cells, that's what CEP9 is involved in.
Okay. So both of those seem to be good candidates for being able to regulate phosphorylation in both the granule neuron precursor regular cells as well as the sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma?
Yeah, we definitely do think that. So this high level of phosphorylation that's prevalent in medulloblastoma compared to granule neuron precursors, we think that this phosphorylation, you know, is actually helping this tumor do its thing in that, you know, either, you know, helps with its invasion properties, perhaps its motility. That's what we think of in terms of CEP9. But then RNF220, we think that maybe phosphorylation can be important in terms of this helping stabilize the RNF220 interaction with other proteins for it to have its function.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does. So your research sounds very promising, right? You've identified some, well, you said 12, but these two really specific ones that you validated. So can you tell us about the potential impact or the significance of your research? Like, where do you think these findings could go in the future, either yourself or with other researchers from the scholarly community taking your work and moving forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the first is how... If we explore, which is what we're currently doing, the functional consequences of what what RNF2 to zero and SEP9 does. So in terms of overexpressing this this gene, what happens, or knocking down this gene, what happens in the medulloblastoma cells, and then figuring out exactly what they're involved in and what their roles are in terms of tumor progression. That's really important.
Okay, yeah.
And another thing that's important in terms of my research is the methodology that I use to identify these candidates. You know, things that are going through phosphorylation, they must be functionally relevant. So through this method of integrating phosphoproteomics data and RNA sequencing data, and then using a method to figure out what exactly is happening in the development and tumor model, we can ultimately find potential candidates in other situations. And this can be a method used by other scientists to figure out what targets are out there and what exactly is relevant in terms of pinpointing and identifying and then further researching.
Oh, that's exciting. So it sounds like you're making two novel contributions, both in the specific identification of candidates as well as methodologically. You've created a bit of a pathway for others to do kind of the same type of exploration, but using different tumor models or different models altogether. So that's really exciting that there's two really distinct contributions that you've got from your master's research.
I also just want to note that, alternative transcripts as a means of regulating phosphorylation, this hasn't been systematically investigated before at the phosphoproteomics level, to my understanding. So this is quite novel in that. Taking it a step back to figure out what is being used to regulate phosphorylation, I think that's really important.
Oh, very cool. So you've got some very, very cutting edge kind of contributions, I don't know, which is super exciting. And where does this research fit into with what other people are doing in your lab currently? Like, are you all working on these cutting edge methods? Like, how did you come up with such an interesting project that makes all these different contributions?
So I'm part of a brain tumor lab, and we study two types of brain tumors. So the pediatric brain tumor, which is the medulloblastoma, and then the brain tumor that's prevalent in adults, which is the glioblastoma.
Okay.
And then we investigate how, we investigate a lot on what this tumor looks like and essentially how we can stop this tumor from developing and progressing and ultimately finding different therapeutics and targets for treatments.
Oh, well, that sounds like a really important place to be. And this sounds like you've kept very busy throughout your master's, right? You've done a lot of work and in a very busy lab, it sounds like, as well, with lots of other research going on. But I've also heard that you have stayed quite involved during your time at Queen's outside of the lab. What are some organizations or programs that you've been involved with on campus during your master's?
Yeah, so I have a passion for student governance, and I think I really like the aspect of community engagement and really building within the bonds that you can create with your fellow students. And so I was involved in my student council in the graduate program, and I was the IEDIA representative. So I created different initiatives to promote principles of equity, inclusion, diversity, accessibility.
Oh, very nice. That's so important to have students involved in making your experience what you want it to be in your department, right? So
It was a really interesting experience, and I think a highlight was when I worked closely with the student council and we created the first ever in person because of COVID,
of course,
health sciences symposium at Queen's, on research that goes on related to these IEDIA principles.
Oh, that's really exciting, because I mean, you're doing research promotion right now, sharing your work, but it's so nice to hear that you and your student council kind of collaborators were able to create a space for other students to share their research and showcase all the really amazing work that people are doing in the life sciences.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really important to highlight how, even as early researchers, how we could integrate principles and make sure that what we're doing is, you know, equitable, we're including. And this can, in terms of even basic science, this can even be making sure that we're including, you know, different, if you're working with different populations, making sure that that's reflected, or understanding sex differences exist in your research as well. Those principles, not overlooking those.
Yeah, no, it carries through in kind of both the work that you do, but also how you do the work. It's important to consider EDI principles and values across both the topics and the applications, I guess, of the research as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what are some other things that you've got up to on campus?
Yeah, I was also part of the Board of Trustees as the graduate student trustee. And the Board of Trustees, it's one of the three main governing bodies of Queen's University. And we oversee things related to the structure, finance of the university.
That sounds like a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, we made a lot of big decisions, including the budget, you know, approving what kind of buildings get renovated, tuition fees, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, that is a lot of important work. And what type of commitment was that?
Yeah, Board of Trustees was a volunteer role, and we meet four times a year.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about what that meeting looks like?
So basically, this is a two-day process.
Wow. Okay, so not your regular meetings.
Yeah, and then we have different committees that meet first, gather and vote on certain committee-related topics, and then ultimately we come together at the end to talk about what the committee talked about and also vote on things that are, you know, essential to everybody being involved. And
like, so pan-university issues you vote on.
Yeah,
and, okay, yeah.
Exactly. And so I was part of the UCC committee, also known as the University Culture Committee.
Okay. And what does the UCC committee take care of?
So the University Culture Committee, we look at Queen's University in terms of workplace culture as well as student experience. And then we talk about, you know, what the current students are feeling, what's the current climate like in terms of Queen's. And then we also approve policies like the harassment and discrimination prevention and response policy.
Oh, okay. Okay. So then you bring those forward and then the university then works to implement those to make sure that we have a good working culture and a good student experience for everyone
who's
a part of Queen's. Okay. Yeah. So that sounds very interesting because it sounds like you had to work with a really large group of people making up the Board of Trustees. Is there, you mentioned there were students. Are you the only student? Were you the only student on the board? Are there other folks that join you or?
So there's three students on the Board of Trustees. So myself, which is the graduate student representative, as well as the undergraduate student representative, and then the rector, which is the representative of all students.
Oh, okay. And working in committees, especially as one of only three students, that it sounds like it could be intimidating or challenging, but what are some things you learned about working with a big group of people in a committee setting where you may be one of the more junior folks in the room? What did you learn from that?
I think, first of all, yeah, it was quite intimidating at first, especially as a lot of people come from different backgrounds. You know, a lot of people with financial expertise, people that have really big titles in their names. But ultimately what helped was first, you know, understanding what this role entails, which is that you are here to represent the graduate students, meaning that you're going to have these difficult conversations as the person in the room that has a voice to speak up and talk to these key decision makers. And so putting that mindset really helped me navigate these intimidating situations, really honing into what this role does. And also what helped was collaboration. Mm-hmm. So I worked closely with both the undergraduate student trustee as well as the rector. And we, before the board meetings, we prepared by figuring out, okay, what's kind of like the main topics we want the board to understand and know about, and how can we integrate it into the agenda items that are being discussed in these meetings, and ultimately be able to effectively communicate what is going on and what is needed. And I just want to say everybody in the Board of Trustees are super duper nice. Mm-hmm. So although at first there's this... It was intimidating at first. No, everybody was super nice, and that allowed me to be comfortable and being able to effectively communicate.
Oh, I'm glad. Well, it's good to know that graduate students have strong representation through yourself, and that our undergraduate students and the whole student body are represented by the undergraduate student rep and the rector. And it's, I think, really nice to see students like yourself taking on such a big volunteer responsibility and taking it so seriously to really effectively represent the wide variety of student voices on campus. So thank you for all of that time and effort that you put into that role, because it's essential to make sure that graduate student voices are heard.
Thank you so much.
Well, Kanna, it has been lovely chatting with you. Thank you so much for doing the show and sharing all of the interesting findings you found in your master's research, and for telling us all about some of your student governance experience on the TMED Student Council and on the Board of Trustees. And best luck with your next steps. And hopefully we will hear all about your work, how it's being carried forward in the rest of your lab. So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.